Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Firefighters Podcast, where we seek to develop, inspire, and motivate the world of the emergency services operator through a series of wide-ranging conversations. Now, before we go any further, just hit that rate, follow, or subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to. It's a key performance indicator for us and helps us reach even more people. Now, here's what we've got for you today. Now, debriefing, also referred to as post-incident reviews, is a formal and sometimes informal method of us having that cyclic learning process, and this is used in all emergency services, especially in UK Fire and Rescue Service. Now, debriefing can range from hot debriefs, which occur at the instant before personnel leave, to large multi-agency debriefs or public inquiry following major incidents. They're an important part of improving personal and organisational performance, and they should take place wherever and whenever there's an opportunity to improve the service delivery. Now, there's also all kinds of kind of active monitoring during the incident, and there's loads of different like operational performance monitoring and mentoring and coaching and observations and all sorts of stuff that can happen. Now, on the podcast, we are going to be doing every single week, optimistically, we are going to be having incident debriefs. Now, a lot of this has been coming through the UK Fire and Rescue Service by means of things like National Operational Learning, National Operational Guidance, and these, again, all exist to facilitate continuous improvement in the sector. What we're going to be looking to do on the podcast is effectively create like a vehicle in audible form for you to come in and learn, listen, reflect, discuss, debate, argue, send in your feedback, make recommendations, and try and share some of the learnings and promote best practice so that at the very least we can avoid making these mistakes again. So we are reaching out far and wide. We've spoken to a whole host of previous guests about incidents they have attended. We're going to be looking at some case studies, and we are also going to be calling out to our listeners of the podcast to send in their incident debriefs, something poignant they've attended, a lesson they want to share. And again, this can all be done anonymously, so don't worry, we're not going to shout your name out if you don't want it to be heard on there. What we really want to do, guys and girls, is just share the learnings. Now, the first incident we're going to look at today is one from Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service. This was on 13th of May 2016. This incident has been known as the Flower Factory and happened at approximately 5:04 on the initial call. This was the 13th of May 2016. Located in Bitton Road, West Southampton, UK, attended by Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service. And the nature of this particular incident was a fire and explosion that came into the crews. It was a warehouse property with commercial sales type and commercial premises used for the production and sale of fireworks, which is always a bit of a tasty thing when you know you're going to an incident with that sort of data on it. It was a semi-detached building built from steel frame and part brick walls, part sandwich panels, glazed frontage, and pitched corrugated asbestos roof over the concrete base. So immediately, when you start thinking about asbestos, you think about fireworks, what are the things that are going through the incident commander's head en route to this sort of premises? So at approximately 5:04, Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service were called to a fire in a flower factory. Three pumping appliances and a station manager were mobilised. The area is within a densely populated residential area. First crews arrived at 5:07, and second and third pumps arriving at approximately 5:11 and 5:12. The crews turned up to a well-developed fire, which included an International Standards Organization ISO container. So that's the big steel containers that you see on ships that contained fireworks. Crews decided to fight the fire to limit fire spread and prevent incident escalation and begun setting up monitors. So when we say monitors, think ground monitors. You see a variety of these different up and down all over the UK. Now, an evacuation procedure was also prioritised, which was begun approximately 5:16. Roads were closed to prevent traffic from passing by the fire. An assistance message for the incident commander, which at the time was a watch manager, was sent also at approximately 5:16, requesting make pump 6. An aerial ladder platform was also requested. Now, the owner of the building was also present at the time, which is good, as they had attended to the scene and gave crews information about the container being half full of fireworks. This, of course, helped create plans for the shop and the crews. Now, approximately 5:30, a further assistance message of make pumps 10 for personnel to assist in evacuation of properties. This was sent by the station manager who had taken over the incident at this time. Just a word to the wise there again, when we're making our assistance messages, of course, we're always putting our justification in there, and this one was for personnel in general. Now, after members of the public were evacuated from the area, crews remained within close proximity to the fire and continued to fight it. At approximately 5:36, a large explosion occurred with some crews exposed to the blast wave. Some firefighters were within approximately 10 metres to 20 metres from the premises at the time of the explosion. Another large explosion was recorded at 5:42 by a body-worn camera showing crews within 20 metres of a major explosion. Further significant explosions were heard and recorded on body-worn cameras. At 5:58 and 6:03, further explosions were heard, and at approximately 6:01, a Make Alps 2 assistance message was sent. Concrete asbestos had been identified as being involved in the incident. Several firefighters suffering ringing in the ears due to their proximity to the major explosion during this particular incident. A police officer was also seen to be in an exposed position while appearing to maintain a road closure cordon during the time of a significant explosion, which was shared as part of the investigation. So we're going to delve into some of the details shared in this debrief. First of all, we're going to look at information gathering. Now, the Fire and Rescue Services Act 2004 imposes a legal obligation on fire and rescue authorities to make provision for obtaining necessary information for extinguishing fire and protecting lives. This obligation is outlined in the service's Integrated Risk Management Plan. That's the IRMP, as a key objective set out in the service policy. Now, every service will have an IRMP, and we all adhere to the Fire Services Act 2004. And again, when we're talking about this information gathering, it's something we all do as incident commanders. When you get there, it's those crucial open and close questions, trying to identify hazards and risks before you get your tactical and strategic plan in place. What's the system of work you're going to use? What's the cordons? What's the justifications? What's the PPE? Getting those building blocks going in your mind. The use of fire safety audits, PORIS and SSRIs. If anybody doesn't use them in their service, that's site-specific risk information. Some people have CAP plans, some people have risk plans. These helped the service gather information needed to assess the fire safety risks and meet its legal duties. Information from third parties such as local licensing authorities can also be seized in order to gather the most information possible. The importance of this information gathering and risk planning is outlined in their service orders as well as part of the incident command appendix. Now, just to recap, at all incidents, all of us, everyone that goes there as an incident commander, the earliest opportunity, we are going to carry out a dynamic risk assessment. You do it all the time. You do it getting off the fire engine. From this, we're going to establish a tactical plan of operation, which means effectively you're going to communicate all of what you've seen, heard, and your dynamic risk assessment to the personnel on the incident ground and transmit it as early as possible by way of an informative message to your fire control. Now, the Flower Factory fire presented a number of hazardous risks to attending crews as identified on the specific SSRI. The investigation found that the appliances 5-4 PAPA 4 and 5-6 PAPA 4 printed off the SSRI en route to the incident. So they printed it off. Great action from the incident commanders, from the JOs on those appliances, printing it off on the front of the pump, beginning to brief your crews what you're going to. There's a container. It may consent, you know, it may have fireworks inside it. Think about physical barriers in terms of protection from explosion. Think about limiting your exposure. Think about cordons. Now, looking at the mobilization to the incident, the investigation found no evidence to show that other attending crews accessed the same information. However, local knowledge of the attending crews may have assisted them in identifying the presence of fireworks at that premises. I'm going to say it definitely did. I mean, the first two appliances en route, usually going to expect the incident commanders or the crew or managers on those appliances to print off the SSRI. It'd be nice if those who are called on the mobilization, who are called on the makeup, are going to print off the SSRI as well. But there's also an expectation that when you arrive at an incident, you are going to be made aware of the hazards that are in that sort of area. But it's worth noting, a good diligent incident commander or JO is going to look at that SSRI en route and ensure they're empowering their crews with the information to make good decisions when they get there. Now, prior to booking in attendance, fire control contacted 5-4 PAP 1 by radio to inform them that the incident involved a fireworks factory. There is no evidence to show that this information was shared with any other appliances or entered onto the log. Again, that might be a miss from their fire control. So there's an expectation that yes, the incident commander and the JO is going to check the SSRI, but if they don't, it's always nice to have that prompt for control to let them know what they are heading into. Now, the PDA, who stands for predetermined attendance for attending an unknown hazmat incident, is identified in their service orders, and this involves three pumping appliances: one RSV, which is a response support vehicle, a TACAD, tactical advisor, a HMEP, so a hazardous materials environmental protection advisor. They'll send one of them to the incident, send one to control, one operational equipment technician, an environmental protection unit, the EPU, and a DIM vehicle. These are regional assets provided via national resilience, that's detection, identification, and monitoring. Now, the incident log for this incident shows adequate pumps were turned out in accordance with the PDA. The log shows a DIM vehicle attending the scene at 8:24. Again, these are regional assets, so even though the mobilization goes out, they could take a couple of hours to get there. So that's 3 hours, 13 minutes after arrival of the first appliance at the scene. These are regional assets. They might not come from that service. Now, the presence of fireworks, explosives, and possible asbestos on the SSRI suggests the incident qualified for a hazmat incident. The log mentioned a firework incident at 5:21, some 10 minutes after arrival, and this came from 5-4 PAP 1 at the scene. There's no evidence to suggest that the incident was identified as a hazmat prior to the first crews arriving. The log itself makes no mention of a specific hazmat incident until 5:34, where a hazardous materials and environmental protection advisor, that HMEPA, is appointed at the incident. A request for a hazmat officer is noted on the log at 6:02, and the hazmat procedure is then activated on the incident log at 6:41. Next up, we're going to look at some of the explosive aspects of this incident, if you excuse the pun. So 5-6 PAPA 4, 5-4 PAPA 4, and 5-4 PAPA 1 approach the premises just before 5:12. Then CCTV from Southampton City Council shows a large plume of smoke emitting into the air around the building. Now, Buller Road runs within 10 to 15 metres of the front of this premises, indicating that all three appliances passed close to the fire on their arrival. Now, if an explosion occurred as the appliances passed the incident in front of the premises, it could have involved crews in a mass explosion, endangering firefighter safety. Now, all these appliances came to a stop behind the building next to the fire on the junction of Buller Road and Cobbett Road. Fire Fact 22 explosives state that fire should be tackled from behind substantial cover. Now, again, we spoke before about physical barriers and... you know what, turning up to this incident, yeah, if you look at the SSRI, you've got to be considering fireworks and stuff like that, but it's just worth having in the back of your mind, what is the physical barriers, what is the physical protection between myself and the potential explosives and also the vehicle itself. The vehicle's going to provide a certain amount of protection, but if you're going to be sat in view of an explosion, there's an opportunity and there's a potential there that this could put you and your crews in significant danger. Evidence has shown that 5-6 Papa 4, 5-4 Papa 4 and 5-4 Papa 1 were shielded by the nearby building that was positioned between the fire and the appliances. The operational investigation found that 5-6 Papa 4, 5-4 Papa 4 and 5-4 Papa 1 took up their final positions in order to leave room for the Alp itself, because again these need a footprint to actually become functional. The appraised crews would have parked near the premises had the Alp not have been ordered. 5-6 Papa 7 arrived at the fire and took up a position approximately 25 metres from the fire in Bitten Road and the junction with Cobbett Road. CCTV footage from the appliance itself shows it was behind substantial cover but in close proximity to the fire. Now, a few recommendations out of that one. If control are aware of an incident that an address and have access to weather information, they could have utilised this, that the information to suggest safe routes to the scene for attending crews and ensure that this is put in the log for crews to follow. Again, this sort of thing is always considered within ethane and methane messages when we're looking at major incidents and best access routes. This is often done with hazmat incidents when we think about wind direction and best direction of approach, but certainly a consideration that could have been done in this sort of one as well. So control. Next, we're looking at control to assess the SSRI, and if explosives are identified, advise crews of minimum approach distances, hazard zones using local landmarks and given crew options of how to approach the premises safely. 5-6 Papa 4, 5-4 Papa 4 and 5-4 Papa 1 approached buildings close together and on the same route. Where explosives are identified, appliances should be deliberately split up and compelled to use different approach routes. This would limit the risk of all appliances becoming involved in an explosion together. Certainly something we see in the military in terms of not clumping everybody together down a narrow corridor. That's effectively what's happening there. If something happens to one, it's going to happen to all of them. So potentially using different approach routes on the same strategic direction. Next, we're going to look at some of the aspects considering asbestos. Now, the CCTV evidence from those vehicles in attendance shows crews in close proximity to the fire on arrival. None of the individuals are shown to be wearing dust masks, despite the mention in the SSRI that the roof sheeting possibly contained asbestos. Now, one of the firefighters describes in their contemporaneous notes that he himself wore full PPE but no BA despite operating a jet 25 metres from the fire. Now, we know that firefighters are putting themselves in these environments, and myself included, you know, going into car fires 15, 16 years ago when I first joined, we're going to have put ourselves in these situations. But when you've been empowered with that knowledge, it is worth those extra few minutes of consideration of what level of face shield, personal respirator, or breathing apparatus needs to be in place to give that firefighter the full proper PPE relevant to the hazard. Now, CCTV from the first appliance at the scene indicates that little information was present about the asbestos risk, since three appliances drove through a smoke plume in front of the premises on their arrival. Now, from a map of the area, it's clear that a downwind route was possible by entering the area westbound on Bitten Road West and then turning right onto Cobbett Road to navigate to the rear of the premises. Such a route would have helped the crews avoid the smoke plume. Identification of the need for dust masks was discussed at the command briefing at 7:36, but some 2 hours after the major explosion at the approximately 5:36. Now, on the available evidence determination that the incident was asbestos, it did not appear to be confirmed until the command briefing at 7:36, where the body-worn video of a station commander confirms that dust masks should be worn. Sadly, only one available analytical risk assessment from the incident, which began at 11:30 in hourly intervals, ending at 18:02 on the same day, identified this hazard. Now, hazmat guidance states it is often difficult to assess if a hazardous material such as asbestos is present when attending an emergency. However, evidence shows that the SSRI referred to possible asbestos in the roof sheeting at number 1 on the hazard overview. It's unclear using the available evidence of the SSRI was available to the incident commander on his arrival, or if there was an oversight of this information until the risk was discussed during the command briefing at 7:36. Now, it's worth mentioning in regard to hazmat guidance that it does outline the default level of respiratory protective equipment at hazardous materials incidents should be self-contained positive pressure breathing apparatus. This should only be varied following a full risk assessment involving a hazmat advisor. Now, CCTV footage shows that the majority of the firefighters within the hazard area and within 20 metres of the fire were not wearing BA or dust masks. This is shown in the contemporaneous notes of the firefighter who was approximately 25 feet away from the fire wearing PPE but no BA owing to the fact that he was outside of the smoke plume. So a few recommendations at the back of this one was all crews attending asbestos incidents should wear dust masks outside the 25 meter cordon recommended by Firefax immediately. All of those within the 25 meters fire should wear full BA and PPE regardless of whether the incident is asbestos minor or major. In asbestos minor incidents, all soil kits should be dampened down before return to station. This obviously stops the contaminant from spreading if it's applied a light mist or water to the PPE itself. In asbestos minor incidents, all soil kits should be contained firstly in a soluble laundry bag and then a plastic outer bag. Remember to gooseneck your bag when you're doing it, folks. So seal the inner bag, big plastic bag on the outside, gooseneck it cable tight, and take that soil clothing back to station. Now next we're going to look at the decision that was made and the fact itself to fight the fire. Now the role of the service in respect to fires involving explosives is outlined in the operational guidance for explosives, which states Hampshire Fire and Rescue's role at the incident is to ensure safety to our personnel if involved and to save and protect the public in an emergency situation. Now Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service role is to also prevent any escalation of an incident from fire and collapse as a result of an explosive substance detonating. During the incident, the decision was taken to tackle the fire, protect the public, and ensure the area was evacuated. It is without question that this was the correct course of action. Contemporaneous notes from those in attendance is clear. For example, from the watch manager himself, the contemporaneous notes read, "We were putting water on the fire in order to limit the fire spread and save lives at the risk of an adjacent building." Contemporaneous notes from one of the firefighters said, "There was a sudden and extended explosion which seemed to take place all around us. My position was approximately 10 meters away from the front of the building to the right of the entrance, and my task as branch operator was to direct the jet at the flames in order to prevent escalation of the incident and protect neighboring properties." On arrival of the first crews just before 5:12, no evacuation procedure had been initiated and the fire was shown on CCTV to be well developed by that point. By 5:16, the evacuation procedure had begun and this is a major priority for the crews. Crews arrived, set up monitors and three handled jets within 10 metres of the front of the premises to tackle the fire. And the fourth firefighter on their appliance and the police officer then started evacuating the premises along Bitton Road West that were adjacent to the fire. The incident commander asked the crew manager to carry out a full recce, so a 360 of the site. But before this was done, the crew manager was asked via handheld radio to relocate an appliance along Bitton Road West to stop westbound traffic approaching the fire. Fire 4 Papa 4 was used to block the road and was eventually positioned at the junction of Bitton Road West and Cobbett Road. Station manager and firefighter 5 set a priority of evacuating members of the public. Station manager 2 told nearby crews to use jets as cover for evacuating the public and not to progress past the defined mark. Evidence supports the suggestion that the evacuation was successful and safeguarded the public as no injuries were reported to the service following the incident. I will pause there and just say it's an incredible action by those in attendance to really consider the evacuation and sort of limit the exposure that this is going to put to the public. However, following successful evacuation, crews remained in close proximity to the fire and continued to dampen the flames. The report itself is obliged to examine whether this was the correct decision and whether the decision to remain in close proximity to the fire post-evacuation endangered the lives of the attending crews. Again, this is the point where you really need to reconsider if my risk that I'm taking is worth the benefit. Yes, we're putting crews in place to dampen down, we're putting crews in place to manage the spread of the fire whilst we evacuate surrounding premises. Once they're evacuated, that's when we talk about that decision cycle. What's my justification for doing this? Now, in the Firefax 22 explosives, this suggests that firefighting only considered if lives would be saved by delaying the explosion by application of large volumes of water. The evidence from crews at the scene shows that their belief was to dampen the flames in order to safeguard the public. Guidance on explosives suggests that dampening fireworks will not extinguish explosives and firefighting should be avoided if there is no doubt as to the location of explosives or if explosives are already involved in fire. Evidence has shown that this is not possible for crews to pinpoint the location of the container from the SSRI, and it is clear that explosives were involved owing to the first explosion at 5:36. Once ignited, explosives will not be extinguished by the application of water, irrespective of the amount used. If fire has already spread to the explosives, the application of water will not extinguish the explosives. The fire should therefore not be fought, as it is impossible to predict both the timing and the extent of a mass explosion. If there is any doubt about the type or location of the explosives, or if it is unclear if the explosives are or are not already involved in fire, the fire should not be fought. Earth embankment or similar substantial cover will provide some protection, but consideration must always be given to the consequences of a blast wave. Small buildings or vehicles offer little protection, and sheltering behind walls can be dangerous because they will only stop small projectiles. Any explosion may overturn vehicles, demolish walls, and in doing so create more projectiles and associated hazards. Now, once an explosion has occurred, secondary explosions can take place from some considerable time. The fighting of secondary fires should not take place until there is a confirmation that no more explosives remain. Footage from this particular incident and the scene shows that fire had started on arrival of the first crews, making predictions for timing and any explosions impossible. Evidence contained in the reports to Occupational Health, contemporaneous notebooks from the crews and CCTV footage shows there is evidence that crews were too close to the fire and therefore safety of the crews may have been put at risk after evacuation had already been completed. To close, we're going to look at cordons in relation to the distance depending on the type of hazard involved. Now, for asbestos containing materials, you should instigate a 25 meter cordon. For explosives, hazmat guidance specifies that an initial cordon should be installed of at least 100 meters. Now, evidence shown in council CCTV, the appliances CCTV, and body worn cameras show that there was no 100 meter cordon in place for the entirety of the incident. A station manager body worn footage at 6:03 shows consultation with a hazmat guide and discussion with colleagues in and around Bitton Road West. At 6:12, the station manager repeats the necessity of a 100 metre cordon to his colleagues. So there are people at the incident that are aware that this 100 metre cordon exists and they are trying to enforce it. Now, there's no evidence on the incident log or CCTV showing attempts to set a 100 metre cordon before the arrival of the station manager and hazmat officer. Now, at 5:36, the rear camera of 56 Papal 4 shows a cordon being erected on Bullard Road and the junction of Bitton Road West only seconds before a huge explosion. The cordon appears to lay approximately 10 to 15 metres from the fire itself, and at 5:45 the rear camera of 56 Papa 7 shows a cordon being erected at the junction of Cobbett Road and Bitton Road West some 10 minutes after the large explosion. The body worn video from station manager 3 shows crews 20 meters from the major explosion at 5:42. CCTV on appliance 56 Papa 4 shows numerous firefighters within 10 to 20 meters of the fire at Buller Road only seconds before a large explosion. Even following the large explosion, crews were seen walking toward the fire and laying monitors as cover. The evidence from this shows that the location of a fire in a densely populated area presented a challenge in setting up a lengthy cordon distance. The fire occurred on a main road junction with Atherston Road and carries a significant responsibility for traffic in the local area. At 5:16, Firefighter 3 is seen on council TV coning off the junction at Buller Road and Bitton Road West some 15 metres from the fire. The footage also shows cars being let through the cones in order to navigate into Buller Road, a road that takes traffic within 10 metres of the fire. So as a final conclusion on cordons, cordons for asbestos should be at least 25 metres. Cordons for retail firework premises should be at least 100 metres. The 100 metre cordon itself was never instigated. Location of the fire made setting up the cordon really difficult, and crews remained in close proximity to the fire when the main explosion had already occurred and during subsequent explosions. Some recommendations detailed in the debrief expand that the use of body-worn cameras at incident is to enrich training post-incident. They gave a real good insights into the steps taken at the incident, but also are invaluable in showing the true dangers at incidents, and especially those involving hazardous materials. It's important for anybody in the investigation process to ensure body-worn footage is seized and stored securely for a period of 50 years. 50 years! Wow! To ensure the service retains evidence and capability to defend future legal claims relating to the personal injury or near-miss incidents. Again, folks, when we're talking about asbestos, when we're talking about our exposure rates, these are the sort of things that 50 years down the line, even 20 years down the line, for people that are going to be retiring from the services and pick up, hopefully don't, but maybe will pick up illnesses that could have been contributed to by the incidents and nature of their job. So folks, we are going to park that one there. That was the Flower Factory, 13th of May 2016, attended by Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service. How did you find it? I hope you found it useful. I hope there was loads going through your mind as we were reading through some of the outcomes of the incident debrief there. Once again, we're going to be looking at doing these incident debriefs once a week, sharing lessons learned with people across the UK Fire and Rescue Service and further afield. If you've got an absolute gold mine case study in your files, if you've got it tucked away on your hard drive somewhere, be sure to send it over to thefirefighterspodcast@gmail.com. We will, of course, if people would like us to, we'll be acknowledging those that send these contributions in so they can share it with the wider world. And again, our sincere desire is to create better educated, more informed, safer operating UK Fire and Rescue Service operators and people from the other aspects of the emergency services. We want you to know this. These misunderstandings, these different interpretation of risks, these have happened before in the past, so let's not repeat them. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you thought of it. If there was too much detail, if there wasn't enough detail, what could make this debrief even better for you and more impactful for you and your teams? Thanks for coming back and listening to the Firefighters Podcast. This one was brought to you by William Wood Watches. William Wood Watches, as I'm sure you're already aware, are the makers of those incredibly authentic watches with a piece of firefighting history in every single one. On the 9th of June, they created 250 beautiful limited edition pieces of the bravest watch for the FDNY Foundation. They're donating 50% from every single watch to the FDNY Foundation. And it's pretty incredible to see that William Hill watches are now in the Rockefeller Center, the FDNY Fire Zone store that's held within Rockefeller Center. On the 9th of June, they will be having one of their watches, which is going to press William Hill watches into the history of FDNY. Johnny and the team are over there kicking ass and taking names. Be sure to join them on their journey. Head over to williamwatches.com, check them out on Instagram, check them out on YouTube. You can check all of their watches right there, from the Jubilee to the Triumph to the Valium to the Bronze to the Chivalrous, and they run competitions supporting firefighters charities all over the world, including the firefighters charity in the UK. So once again, thanks for coming back to the Firefighters Podcast. Go and check out William Hill watches. Go and check us out on YouTube. Subscribe if you're listening on Spotify, if you're listening on one of those platforms. Followers, raters, thanks for coming back, and we look forward to seeing you again real soon right here on the Firefighters Podcast.